This is 89.9 WWNO. Yes, we're headed for another art-filled week. Are you making plans or do you need some ideas? Well, you've come to the right place. Whether you're in the mood for a celebration of cultures or conversation with a jazz master, it's all in the mixed media. Come along as we go inside the arts. Hi, I'm your host, Diane Mack. New Orleans is now home to the fifth Mexican Cultural Institute in the country. The appointment by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Mexico promotes a special connection between Mexico, Latin America, and the Crescent City through art and culture. The institute, located within the Mexican consulate, opens with a new exhibit by artist Belinda Flores Chinchillas. It's called Decoding the Purity of an Icon. Belinda is here with Lorena Salazar, director of the Mexican Cultural Institute. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Diane.
Lorena, let's begin with you. What does this appointment mean for the city of New Orleans?
Well, as you mentioned, there are several cultural institutes. They are located in cities such as Paris, Madrid, New York. And I think that to establish a cultural institute in New Orleans really recognizes the cultural activity and the art personality of the city. And we are very excited to open.
And your work, Belinda, an exhibit called Decoding the Purity of an Icon, kicks off opening celebrations. Tell us about this series of oil paintings and how the exhibit came about.
One day I was reflecting on how women is portrayed through art history. In the medieval times, iconography was the means to portray women as figures of power and strength and spirituality, you know. But there was a lot of prejudice behind portraying strong women, because they didn't have any rights. They didn't exist, really, you know, in society. So that made me think how I can transport that conversation into a contemporary conversation with women trying to find that gender equality in our history now. So I came with the idea to use that style of iconography with the same three colors that portrayed power, that is red, ultramarine, and golden. But I wanted to portray people that I know, that I have a connection with them. And the 10 women that are portrayed in my paintings, they're my friends, and they all have a strong story to tell. When I finished the paintings, I wanted to create two installations. One is called Decipher, about my vision of how your eyes tells your story. They're not just a window to your soul. They're the conversation of your soul. I painted the eyes of my friends on aluminum plates. When you're looking at the installation, you're looking at the eyes of the 10 women, but you're also looking at your reflection. It's a double way to put you inside of their feelings and their soul. And then the other one is about vessels. And for me, vessels are objects that hold purity. They can hold water. They can hold holy liquids. Those installations complement the exhibition of the 10 oil paintings. You will experience an honest story about how these contemporary women are strong, are beautiful, and they're spiritual. Every portrait has its own personality.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. You were born in Mexico City?
Yeah, I was born and raised in Mexico City, and I came to live in the United States in 1999. And I came to the United States to live in the Southwest. That was a clash for me, you know, coming from an urban environment like Mexico City. And then I came to New Orleans. And I think that coming to live to New Orleans from a place like Mexico City, it was, you know, it was the right thing for me, because New Orleans is such a welcoming city and it's so diverse and it's multicultural. So for me as an artist and as a person, I didn't feel that I was living outside of my comfort zone, you know. Mm-hmm. I was at home since the beginning, and it was the city. The city embraced me. And I embrace the city. It's an amazing place to live. I love New Orleans.
Then, Lorena, how will you further these cultural connections and the image of Mexico in this country as head of the new Mexican Cultural Institute?
Mexico is a big country, multicultural country, and many people only know one face of Mexico, violence and immigration. So we would really like to create a space for Mexican art and Mexican artists to present many of our several faces and to start a conversation with the U.S. so we can know us better as neighbors and as friends.
Artists Belinda Flores-Chincias and Lorena Salazar, director of the Mexican Cultural Institute, it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you, Diane. Thank you for having us.
Decoding the Purity of an Icon, an exhibit by Mexican-American artist Belinda Flores-Chincias, is on view at the Mexican Cultural Institute, 901 Convention Center Boulevard, Suite 118, through May 14th. The 49th New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival, presented by Shell, kicks off this week. It's a tricentennial celebration. Jazz Fest is dedicating its cultural exchange pavilion to the city's 300th birthday bash. Valerie Guillet is the pavilion coordinator. She joins us with guests Nick Scramuzza, Beth Patterson, and Dr. Michael White. Welcome.
Good day.
Thank you.
How's it going?
Hello.
You are celebrating numerous cultures that have made the rich gumbo that New Orleans is today. Valerie, tell us, how are you approaching this cultural celebration?
We wanted to really focus on some of the cultures that are lesser known or not necessarily associated with New Orleans. You know, New Orleans was such a huge port, an immigration point in the 1850s, second after New York. So we have such an amazing influx of Germans, Italians, Irish that are settling here and really making an impact on the local culture, which is obviously rooted in Native American culture, African culture, the Creole gumbo that we know from the early days. But there are many more influences. And then later on, Vietnamese and Hispanic. So it is a real amazing, beautiful gumbo.
And Nick, what's going to be your role?
I will be building the St. Joseph altar. The altar is to thank and celebrate St. Joseph, who saved the Sicilians dating back to the 12th and 13th century when there was a great famine. And if you're familiar with the fava or the lucky bean, our ancestors prayed to St. Joseph. That crop grew and it became the lucky bean. And fortunately for me and luckily for me, I will be representing the Sicilian and Italian immigrants of New Orleans over the last 300 years. The Italians and Sicilians were here from the very beginning. A lot of people don't realize that. They think it was like the French came in and then the Spanish were here. But in that system of setting up government and running the system, the Italians have always been here. And with them came the St. Joseph altar and the things you think of today that are New Orleanian and Italian at the same time.
And Beth Patterson.
Hello.
I hear Irish music will be big this weekend. Tell us a little bit about yourself and what can we look forward to here?
I'll be playing with two wonderful musicians, Pete Dawson, who plays simple cistern Irish wooden flute and tin whistles, and Frank Bladden, who plays the baron, which is a frame drum and one of the oldest traditional Irish instruments. We'll be playing jigs and reels, traditional dance music, and I've put the word out in the Irish music community to come by and bring an instrument if they happen to be wandering by during those times that we'll be playing. I didn't get into Irish music until I was in high school. It was just starting to be on the rise of its popularity. A friend of mine got me turned on to bands that had the bouzouki in it, which is, of course, a traditional Greek instrument. But it got into Irish music in the late 60s, mid to late 60s. What I've got is an adaptation that quickly took off.
This is a stringed instrument?
It is a stringed instrument. The version that I play is more like an octave mandolin than a true bowl-backed Mediterranean instrument. I've got an 8-string that'll be taken to the festival. I think it's going to be wicked fun. It'll be reminiscent of when I lived in Ireland for a while. I was a student at University College Cork, and even though my studies were in traditional Irish music studies and ethnomusicology, the most important research I did was in the pubs.
And you're a founding member of the Poor Clares.
Yes, I am.
And Dr. Michael White, jazz clarinetist and music historian. I hear there's going to be some special tributes to New Orleans musical giants on the Cultural Exchange Pavilion stage. Who's being honored?
Well, we're very happy to present some of the most important figures in early jazz. We couldn't, of course, honor traditional New Orleans jazz without the greatest of them all, Louis Armstrong. So we have Kermit Ruffins doing a tribute to Louis Armstrong. As well, we're doing a tribute to Jelly Roll Morton, who was the first great jazz composer. And we're very happy to do that, as well as feature New Orleans-born piano wizard Henry Butler. We also have a tribute to one of the first great jazz musicians on record, Sidney Bechet, soprano saxophonist and clarinetist. And of course, what would traditional jazz be without brass band? So we have a special brass band tribute. We're doing a Heritage All-Star Brass Band and getting together some of the guys that started out in brass bands and had been playing in the older brass band tradition as it existed throughout most of the 20th century.
Are you going to be performing?
Yes, I'm going to be playing in the Heritage All-Star Brass Band, and I'll also be with the Jelly Roll Morton tribute. And we also have the music of one of the great jazz bands in history, King Oliver's Creole Jazz Band, featuring Don Vappy.
And Valerie, will there be any cultural representations of food?
We do have a food booth right by the Cultural Exchange Pavilion with Loretta's pralines. She's actually making a special and very traditional treat this year, which are calas. They were a staple of the French market in the 18th and 1900s. A lot of free women of color and slaves would sell these at the market to make some money. So that's something that was very traditional, and she will be serving them. They're rice fritters, by the way. Look out for those. They're super traditional. They kind of have disappeared, but there's a movement to bring them back.
What will be the big takeaway as the world literally comes to our city for this cultural blowout?
You will hopefully learn something about New Orleans that you didn't know.
Because of the music that I do, it encourages a lot of dancing and a lot of drinking, so I say sore leg muscles and liver damage.
The special spirit that we have here in our music that really makes you think about the good side of life and living.
And I'd like to follow up with this being a gumbo, and not only how much have we contributed to the world, but how much the world has contributed to us.
Cultural Exchange Pavilion Coordinator Valerie Guillet, Italian Community Spokesman Nick Scramuzza, and musicians Beth Patterson and Dr. Michael White. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The 2018 New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival kicks off Friday, April 27th, and runs through Sunday, May 6th. At the New Orleans Fairgrounds. You're listening to Inside the Arts on 89.9 WWNO, New Orleans Public Radio. I'm Diane Mack. Ron Carter is one of the world's finest bassists and is, without question, the most recorded bass man on the planet. To date, he's played on over 2,500 recordings, with more on the way. Ron Carter plays Jazz Fest Friday with a great trio, including guitarist Russell Malone and pianist Donald Vega. WWNO's Fred Kasten has more.
Ron Carter was born in the Detroit suburb of Ferndale, Michigan, grew up in Detroit proper, started playing cello at age 10.
The local orchestra director brought some instruments to the school and laid them on the table and said, I'm going to start an orchestra here, and you children pick an instrument that you want to play. And after she kind of demonstrated most of them, if I can recall, the cello seemed to have a sound that I thought I could make something out of. Not sure what that would be or how long it would take.
You still play cello some, don't you?
Only to amaze myself and scare my friends.
Ron Carter stuck with cello until his senior year in high school. When the bass chair opened up in his school orchestra, he made the switch to bass.
It was made clear to me that my better options to be a musician in life would be not to play cello anymore, but to play string bass. Sold my cello and got a bass and paid for it on time with a paper route that I had at the time, and had maybe 8 lessons on string bass from the local bass player, and auditioned for the school, and they thought that I had enough talent to give me a full scholarship for 4 years.
That school was the Eastman School of Music in Rochester, New York, where it turned out economic necessity helped to introduce Ron Carter to jazz.
When I was switched to string bass and went away to college for the first year, I couldn't stay in school for the next year unless I had some extra funds coming in from my summer job. My friends who were my neighbors were already listening to Early Miles and Dave Brubeck with his big hit, Jazz Goes to College, and they knew who Chet Baker was, and they knew who Charlie Parker was. They knew who Bud Powell was, and I knew their names just from reading newspapers, but had no acquaintance with their music. They told me they needed a bass player to do some summer jobs, which were frat parties on boat rides in Detroit. So I said, well, I don't know the library. I said, we can show you some tunes, and you're on your own. So they showed me 3 or 4 tunes, a general idea of what changes were, and some possibilities as near as they could figure out as not bass players. I said, well, I think I'd be good at this. Let me try this. So that's how it started.
He was indeed very good at that. And after earning his bachelor's degree at Eastman, he moved to New York City with a master's from the Manhattan School of Music in mind.
My plan was to go to New York, work some gigs, get some money so I could, again, afford all the expenses that grad school had despite having a small scholarship. As it turned out, Chico Hamilton was looking for a bass player when I got to New York, and I got the word, so I went down to Birdland, and he said, was I looking for some work? I said, no, I just can't hear the band. He said, well, I'm looking for a bass player. Can you play the book? I said, well, I don't know. I haven't seen it. So I looked at the book during the intermission, and he said, okay, well, we're leaving day after tomorrow. Are you available? So I said, yes, and it got started.
Wow, just that quick.
Yeah.
After 6 months on the road with Chico Hamilton, Ron Carter came back to New York City, went back to grad school, completed his master's, and in 1961 took another major career step.
I made my first solo record out at Rudy Van Gelder's under my name with Eric Dolphy, Charlie Persip, and Mel Waldron, 1961.
Also in the early 60s, composition became a significant part of Ron Carter's creative life.
I was doing a couple of dates on my own for different labels. Prestige was one of them. Embryo was the one with Herbie Mann's label.
Right.
And it just seemed to me I understood enough about how the process worked and had studied composition as a part of my college studies. I thought that I had a pretty good chance of making some melodies that seemed to be interesting to other people. So I sat down and made some compositions for my first date out at Rudy's, and they seemed to be pretty successful with the guys in the band. And I decided that I should probably devote more time and trust my instincts that I'm maybe not too bad at this process.
In 1963, Miles Davis came calling, asking Ron Carter to join his new quintet with Wayne Shorter, Herbie Hancock, and Tony Williams.
I was working with Art Farm at the time, and he walked in and explained to me that the band that he had with Wynton and Paul and Jimmy Cobb was breaking up because they were going to be the trio behind West Montgomery, but that Jimmy was going to finish his last tour with him, and he needed a bass player, and one of those was available. So I told him I was already committed to Art Farmer, but if you, Mr. Davis, will ask Art for permission to allow me to not finish up my commitment to him, and says it's okay to leave, I'm happy to go. So he went over and asked Art Farmer, and Art Farmer agreed that I could leave, and that's how I got started.
That group went on to become widely appreciated as one of the finest small ensembles in jazz history. And Ron Carter has to date played on over 2,500 recordings with a host of the finest musicians on the planet.
My list of playing with jazz greats is down to one now, Mr. Ahmad Jamal, and he's on my list. I'm trying to get him to find some time at some point between now and whenever spring comes to New York, which seems like quite a ways away.
Oh, my.
to sit down and play with me so I can get him off my list.
Yes. Is that a long list when it started?
It was, but now it's down to one very, very important person.
Ron Carter has also enjoyed some opportunities through the years to record classical music.
That's not because that's not what I'm noted for in the music industry, which is unfortunate that they have allowed my pigeonhole fame to get in the way of me getting chance to play other musics. Having said that, I have made some classically oriented records. I did a record called Brandenburg No. 3, where I play the bass parts based on that piece. And I've done some Nonet records where I have taken some classical melodies, Rachmaninoff, Satie, and made some jazz versions of those with a Nonet featuring Hubert Laws. So I've had some experience finding music despite them.
He's also recorded work by great jazz composers with classical artists. For example, the Monk CD he made with the Kronos Quartet.
I did a couple of Bach records, one with a Bach piece of the Bach chorales, and one featuring the Bach cello music, only the dance movements on string bass. So I've had some experience and wonderful time having a chance to play this music that was originally written way before my time. I can't help but have the feeling that if these composers were alive, they would say someone finally found out how to play my music.
That's right.
They knew if they waited long enough,
yep,
it would happen. Ron Carter brings a great trio to Jazz Fest Friday afternoon.
Russell Malone on guitar and Donald Vega on piano, who replaced Mungo Miller. We've been together 4 or 5 years. We've made a couple of really nice trio records, and the library is getting bigger each time we have a rehearsal before the next set of gigs. We're going to do a summer tour as soon as they work out the final dates, and I'm looking forward to reuniting with those guys when we get down to New Orleans and have a chance to make some new discoveries between eating poor boys and enjoying New Orleans.
Bass great Ron Carter. His trio plays Jazz Fest Friday, April 27th. For 89.9 WWNO, I'm Fred Kasten.
That's our show for this week. Support for Inside the Arts comes from the Helles Foundation. Our program is a production of WWNO and is archived at WWNO.org. I'll be back with more ideas for your artistic palette on Tuesdays at 1 p.m., Wednesdays at 8:30 p.m., and a shortened edition on Thursday mornings at 8:45 when we'll go Inside the Arts. I'm Diane Mack.